Hello from VOA Learning English, and welcome to As It Is, our daily 30-minute radio show and podcast that helps you learn everyday American English. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. It is Monday, January 18th, 2016. Today is a national holiday in the United States. It honors the civil rights leader, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. On our program yesterday, we presented part one of our two-part program about the life of Dr. King. Today, we will tell you more about him, what he did for this country, and why he is honored with a national holiday. Later, we will present our popular history program, The Making of a Nation. Today, we will continue the story of President William McKinley and the Spanish-American War. But first, we will report on the events of the past few days. Iran released 5 Americans being held in prisons. And the U.S. dropped charges against or released 7 Iranians who had been accused or convicted of helping Iran avoid economic sanctions. So you can see we have a lot for you today. Every day here on As It Is, we bring you news from and about America and the world. We are on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We are the voice of America. A day after lifting economic sanctions against Iran for meeting the terms of the nuclear agreement, the U.S. announced new, limited sanctions against several Iranian citizens and companies for helping Iran's ballistic missile program. The new sanctions were announced shortly after a plane carrying Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian and 2 other American citizens freed in a prisoner exchange, arrived in Switzerland. On Saturday, the U.S. released or dropped charges against 7 Iranians, either convicted or accused of helping Iran avoid long-standing sanctions in exchange for Iran's release of 5 Americans. The exchange came after the United Nations Nuclear Agency confirmed that Iran had met the conditions of an agreement it signed last July after 2 years of negotiations to limit its nuclear activities. Under the agreement, Iran moved almost all of its nuclear fuel out of the country, destroyed and removed its nuclear equipment, and gave international inspectors greater access to its nuclear facilities. Shortly after the announcement that Iran had met the terms of agreement, the United States and other world powers lifted oil and economic sanctions. They had severely damaged the Iranian economy. On Sunday, President Barack Obama said that strong American diplomacy led to the end of sanctions and the release of American prisoners held by Iran. Also on Sunday, the U.S. Treasury Department announced the new sanctions on 5 individuals and several companies. The president said last year's nuclear agreement was never intended to resolve all of our differences with Iran. We will continue to enforce these new sanctions vigorously. We are going to remain vigilant about it. Earlier on Sunday, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said in a speech to the Iranian people that the country had entered a new chapter in its history. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has opposed the nuclear agreement since it was announced. Saturday, after the UN said Iran had met the terms of the agreement, he warned that Iran has not ended its ambition to obtain nuclear weapons and continues to act to destabilize the Middle East and spread terror throughout the world. Many of President Obama's political opponents also criticized the end of the sanctions. Now we have more to tell you about the man Americans are remembering today, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Shep O'Neill and Warren Shear are here with part two of our two-part report on the life and death of the civil rights leader.
Martin Luther King was born in Atlanta, Georgia, in 1929. He began his university studies when he was 15 years old and received a doctorate degree in religion. He became a preacher at a church in Montgomery, Alabama. In 1955, a black woman in Montgomery was arrested for sitting in the white part of a city bus. Dr. King became the leader of a protest against the city bus system. It was the first time that black Southerners had united against the laws of racial separation. At first, the white citizens of Montgomery did not believe that the protest would work. They thought most blacks would be afraid to fight against racial separation. But the buses remained empty. Some whites used tricks to try to end the protest. They spread false stories about Martin Luther King and other protest leaders. One story accused Martin of stealing money from the civil rights movement. Another story charged that protest leaders rode in cars while other protesters had to walk. But the tricks did not work, and the protest continued.
Dr. King's wife, Coretta, described how she and her husband felt during the protest. She said, "We never knew what was going to happen next. We felt like actors in a play whose ending we did not know. Yet we felt a part of history, and we believed we were instruments of the will of God." The white citizens blamed Dr. King for starting the protest. They thought it would end if he was in prison or dead. Dr. King was arrested twice on false charges. His arrests made national news, and he was released. But the threats against his life continued.
The Montgomery bus boycott lasted 382 days. Finally, the United States Supreme Court ruled that racial separation was illegal in the Montgomery bus system. Martin Luther King and his followers had won their struggle. The many months of meetings and protest marches had made victory possible. They also gave blacks a new feeling of pride and unity. They saw that peaceful protest, Mahatma Gandhi's idea of nonviolence, could be used as a tool to win their legal rights.
Life did not return to normal for Dr. King after the protest was over. He had become well known all over the country and throughout the world. he often was asked to speak about his ideas on nonviolence. Both black and white Americans soon began to follow his teachings. Groups were formed throughout the South to protest peacefully against racial separation. The civil rights movement spread so fast that a group of black churchmen formed an organization to guide it. The organization was called the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Martin Luther King became its president. In his job, Dr. King helped organize many protests in the southern part of the United States. Blacks demanded to be served in areas where only whites were permitted to eat, and they rode in trains and buses, formerly for whites only. These protests became known as freedom rides. Many of the freedom rides turned violent. Black activists were beaten and arrested. Some were even killed.
In 1963, the black citizens of Birmingham refused to buy goods from the stores in the city. They demanded more jobs for blacks, and they demanded to send their children to white schools. The white citizens were angry and afraid, but they refused to meet the blacks' demands. The situation became tense. Many protesters were beaten and arrested. Even Dr. King was arrested, but he was not in prison for long. The Birmingham demonstrations made international news. Whites soon saw that it was easier to meet the demands of the protesters than to fight them. Martin Luther King and his followers had won an important victory in Birmingham. It marked a turning point for the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King recognized the importance of Birmingham. It did not mean that racial separation had ended. Some still remains today. But he felt that the battle was almost won, and he wanted to call on the nation for its support. So, Dr. King organized a march on Washington, D.C. The March on Washington took place in August 1963. About 250,000 persons gathered there. They came to demand more jobs and freedom for black Americans. There were to be many other marches in Washington during the 1960s and early 70s, but this was the biggest up to that time.
It was in Washington that Martin Luther King gave one of his most famous speeches. The speech is known as the I Have a Dream speech. It expressed his ideas for the future. Dr. King said,
"So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. This is our hope. This is a faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. When we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Martin Luther King received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964. But he did not live to see the final results of his life's work. He was shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee, in 1968. Dr. King always felt he would die a violent death. His life had been threatened wherever he went, and he often spoke to his wife about his fears. But he never believed that his life was more important than the civil rights movement. The night before he died, he spoke to his supporters. He said,
"We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. Like anybody, I would like to live, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord."
You have been listening to the story of civil rights leader, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. This program was written by William Rogers and presented by Shep O'Neill and Warren Shear. You are listening to As It Is, a daily program from VOA Learning English. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Now it is time for our popular American history series, The Making of a Nation. The Spanish-American War took place in the late 1800s, during the presidency of William McKinley. On December 10, 1898, the United States and Spain signed a treaty in Paris, officially ending the war between them. However, the fighting had stopped much earlier. Spain had made the first move toward peace after its forces surrendered at Santiago on the Cuban coast. A few weeks before that, the United States Navy had destroyed Spain's Atlantic fleet. The American naval victory ended any chance that Spain could win the war. Now, Doug Johnson and Steve Ember continue the story of President William McKinley and the Spanish-American War.
Late in July, the French ambassador in Washington gave President William McKinley a message from the Spanish government. Spain asked what terms the United States would demand for peace. President McKinley sent an immediate answer. Spain, he said, must give up Cuba. It must also give to the United States the islands of Puerto Rico and Guam. And he said Spain must recognize the right of the United States to occupy Manila in the Philippines. The future of the Philippines, he said, would be decided during negotiations on a peace treaty.
McKinley's terms seemed severe to Spain. But Spain had no choice. It could not continue the war. So, 10 weeks after war broke out, Spain agreed to stop the fighting and accept the American terms. It signed a peace agreement in Washington on August 12th. A Spanish note protested sadly that the agreement took away the last memory of a glorious past. It expels us from the Western Hemisphere, which became peopled and civilized through the proud efforts of our fathers.
The two countries agreed to meet in Paris to negotiate details of a peace treaty. The talks opened October 1st. The two sides agreed quickly on the issue of Cuban independence and an American takeover of Puerto Rico and Guam. But they could not agree on what to do about the Philippines. At the beginning of the talks, the United States was not sure if it wanted all or only part of the Philippines. At first, President McKinley wanted Spain to give up only Luzon, the main island. Then he decided that the United States should demand all of the Philippines. McKinley explained later how he made this decision.
I thought first we would take only Manila, then Luzon, then other islands, perhaps. I walked the floor of the White House many nights. More than once I went down on my knees and asked God to help me decide. And one night, said McKinley, it came to me this way, that we could not give the Philippines back to Spain. That would be cowardly and dishonorable. We could not turn them over to France or Germany, our trading competitors in Asia. That would be bad business. We could not leave them to themselves. They were not ready for self-government. So there was nothing for us to do but to take them all, and to educate the Filipinos, to civilize them, and make Christians of them. With that decision, said McKinley, I went to bed and slept well.
Spain, however, did not want to give up the Philippines. It protested that the United States had no right to demand the islands. True, Americans occupied Manila, but they did not control any other part of the Philippines. The two sides negotiated for days. Finally, they reached an agreement. Spain would give all of the Philippines to the United States. In return, the United States would pay Spain $20 million. With this dispute ended, the peace treaty was quickly completed and signed. But trouble developed when President McKinley sent the treaty to the United States Senate for approval.
Many Americans opposed the treaty. They thought McKinley was wrong to take the Philippines. Opponents of the treaty included former President Cleveland, industrialist Andrew Carnegie, labor leader Samuel Gompers, writer Mark Twain, and others. They organized anti-imperialist groups in many cities to oppose the treaty. They made speeches and published newspapers explaining their opposition. Imperialism, they said, had ruined ancient Rome, and it would ruin the American Republic. They said colonies halfway around the world would be costly to protect. A large army and navy would be needed. They said colonial policies violated important democratic ideas upon which the United States had been built. We went to war with Spain, they said, to free Cuba from its colonial masters, not to make ourselves masters of the Philippines.
Republican Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts led the Senate fight for the treaty. The opposition was led by the other Massachusetts senator, George Hoar, also a Republican. Senator Lodge appealed to national pride. He urged the Senate not to pull down the American flag. Rejection of the treaty, he said, would dishonor the president and the country. It would show that we are not ready as a nation to enter into great questions of foreign policy. Senator Albert Beveridge of Ohio also spoke in support of the treaty. Senator Beveridge said the Pacific would be of great importance in coming years. Therefore, he said, the power that rules the Pacific will be the power that rules the world. And with the Philippines, that power is and forever will be the United States.
Senator Hoar spoke strongly against the treaty. He said that taking over the Philippines would be a dangerous break with America's past. He said the greatest thing the United States had was its tradition of freedom. To take the Philippines, he said, would deny that tradition. It would violate the Constitution and the ideas contained in the Declaration of Independence, the idea that all men are created equal, and that government exists only with the permission of the governed.
The Senate vote on the treaty was set for February 6th. It seemed that the opposition had enough votes to reject it. But several things happened before the vote. William Jennings Bryan, the leader of the Democratic Party, opposed the takeover of the Philippines. But he urged Democratic senators to vote for the treaty. Bryan was looking ahead to the presidential election in 1900. He believed that the Philippines takeover would cause the United States nothing but trouble. He could put the blame for all the trouble on the Republicans. Then, if he was elected president, the Democrats could give the Philippines their independence. Bryan succeeded in getting 17 Democrats and populists in the Senate to vote for the treaty.
2 days before the vote was taken, violence broke out in the Philippines. President McKinley, without waiting for the Senate to act, ordered the American military government in Manila to extend its control throughout the Philippines. The leader of the Philippine rebels, Emilio Aquinaldo, opposed the order. Rebel forces prepared to fight. On the night of February 4th, 30,000 rebels attacked American forces around Manila. 60 Americans were killed, and more than 270 were wounded. Rebel losses were much higher.
News of the rebel attack caused some senators to change their minds about the Philippines. Some opponents of the treaty now agreed with the Washington Star newspaper that the Filipinos must be taught to obey. 84 senators were present for the vote on the treaty. To pass, the treaty needed a two-thirds majority, 56 votes. One by one, the senators voted. Then, the count was announced. 57 of the lawmakers had voted yes. Only 27 had voted no. The treaty was approved. The Philippines belonged to the United States. And that's our program for today. I'm Jonathan Evans. We will be back tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English here on the Voice of America.